Welcome to Soundings, a weekly cultural affairs program featuring conversations and commentary from the National Humanities Center. Major funding for Soundings comes from the National Endowment for the Humanities. Additional support for Soundings comes from the A.J. Fletcher Foundation and from Carolina Power and Light, where listening generates powerful ideas.
Rethinking Roman History, this week on Soundings. I'm Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Join me now for a conversation featuring Susan Trajari of Stanford University and Richard Talbert of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill.
This, after all, is a society where it's very hard to pass on, to gain new wealth except through inheritance. It's, after all, not a very capitalist society in a modern sense. It certainly isn't industrialized. Mm-hmm. And it's also a very competitive and snobbish society, so that status, both high and low, matters a great deal to people.
It sounds to me like women would... Historian Richard Talbert. Over the last half century, scholars have uncovered new and revealing material, both archaeological and documentary, about early Roman culture, which covers the first two centuries of the Common Era. As a result of this new evidence, ancient historians are reassessing the early Roman Empire with attention to issues such as domestic life, as well as more traditional historical themes, such as politics and the military. Historians Richard Talbert and Susan Trajari recently participated in one such reassessment at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. The title of the program was Changing Perspectives on the Early Roman Empire. Richard Talbert, Susan Trajari, Edward Gibbon says that if there is a time in human history when people were really happy, it was the first couple of centuries of the Roman Empire. Richard, is he right or wrong?
It all depends who you are and who you were. In many ways, in the first two centuries A.D., sure, life was peaceful and prosperous if you were well set up in Roman society and enjoyed speaking Latin and wearing a toga. If you preferred speaking British or Celtic and running around with woad on you and not taking part, and you were likely to be drafted into the army or go work in a mine when you didn't want to, How did you feel about it then?
What about women and women's issue? Questions of gender, Susan Trajari.
Well, prostitutes wore togas, so I wouldn't have wanted to do that particularly. I think they had it really rough. I think for women, not too bad at all, but you'd want to be a fairly upper class, or at least a freedwoman of a very prosperous family, and you wouldn't want to be too close to the emperor, because you might get caught on an adultery charge and sent off to a very small hot island off the coast of Italy.
What was the name of that island? This was the real sort of outer, being an outcast.
Pantelleria was the worst. Right. Pantelleria off the African coast, really closer to Africa.
My goodness. Now, when we talk about Gibbon looking back and saying if there was a time of harmony and peace in human history, we can accuse him of injecting his own time, his own politics, into a statement like that. To put it bluntly, what prevents you modern Roman historians from doing the same thing? Richard?
Nothing at all, except there are some features we can look back to and we can't quarrel with, that it is remarkable that there was this amount of the Earth's surface that was to some extent a unified administrative entity where war for the vast majority of the population was banished for hundreds of years. Mm-hmm. There's been nothing like it in Europe before or since.
When we talk about power, whether we're talking about power at vast political levels or power within the home and the family, Richard Talbert, Susan Trajari, did the Romans know things that we don't know? Susan?
Well, the family angle on that is that the theory says, of course, the man is the boss. The Roman angle on it seems to me that cooperation is the absolute key word, and I find that rather appealing. Cooperation, harmony, working together, and in fact giving the woman almost the priority in the domestic sphere. The received stereotype comes over very well in the epistles on the topic, where St. Paul or the author of 1 Peter are... giving you the Greek theoretical line on proper subordination in the household.
And being unfair to the Romans.
Well, it doesn't reflect Roman ideals by that date, really. Uh-huh. But it does reflect the fact that the Christian authors are very keen to show the pagans that their standards of order and discipline and proper hierarchy in the household are just as good.
What about this issue of political control, political power? You know, the one and the many, the large, the small. I'll put the question to you, Richard. Did the Romans know things about political management that we haven't yet figured out? What accounts for that long, vast period of stability and harmony? There was power involved, to be sure.
Surely.
How was it used?
I think it was mainly by delegation and by giving everybody at his own level full authority to carry on with the job. Mm-hmm. So that, for much of the time, as indeed happened, the emperor could be somebody who was completely uninterested or was completely off his head. It didn't that for the most part didn't matter, because mm-hmm. the governors and the prefects at the next level down had full authority in their areas, and each local community, each town council could run its affairs.
So it was like a democracy in these sort of subset levels, although as a whole you don't characterize it as a democratic society.
No way. No, certainly not. That uh-huh. It was very much a matter of wealth and status and power all going together.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things I did in this way was to put together simply a list of all the resolutions of the Senate in the first 2.5 centuries AD. And amazingly, this was something which nobody had ever tried to do before.
What did this reveal?
Well, it put together, it showed a very active assembly in a way that went completely against the accepted view of the Senate in that period.
And give me a thumbnail sketch. What do you mean? Avaricious, power-hungry white males who are bludgeoning women and children over the head, in contrast to what?
No, an influential group of the most powerful citizens in Roman society who were legislating particularly about many issues of burning concern to high society in that period, indeed even low society.
Name one. What do you mean?
Inheritance, issues of status. This, after all, is a society where it's very hard to pass on, to gain new wealth except through inheritance. It's, after all, not a very capitalist society in a modern sense. It certainly isn't industrialized.
Mm-hmm.
And it's also a very competitive and snobbish society, so that status, both high and low, matters a great deal to people.
It sounds to me like women would really have a rough row to hoe in Roman society, Susan Trajari. I mean, they had no, to use a word that Richard Talbert just used, mm-hmm. your status. Am I right?
They did.
Oh, they did.
Their status was that of their fathers or husbands.
Uh-huh.
That's the theoretical rule about it. Of course, they did have their own very often as well. I mean, if they married down, they might still have the status that went with their original birth. But what Richard was saying, I think, is very interesting, because the opinion I've been forming about these decrees of the Senate is that they tried very hard to legislate for society as a whole. And scholars have had a tendency to say such and such a measure is in favor of women, or indeed slaves. Both of whom are groups unrepresented in the Senate. And I think this black and white distinction between pro and anti
mm-hmm.
in the development of law doesn't work. They're looking at a much broader picture, and they're striving very often for what we would call equity, and indeed what they would call equity. So that some measures will, to our minds, be favorable to women, like letting women inherit from their children, on intestacy, that is. And others will perhaps push the balance the other way.
Now, you just used the word slave, mm-hmm. Susan Trajari. How is it that we can look back to a society that furnishes us with so many cultural models, if not stereotypes, which nonetheless practiced and subscribed to this awful institution that we now think of ourselves as free of? Are we so much more enlightened? I mean, how do you account for this paradox, Richard Talbert?
I think we're the oddballs here. I think almost all or perhaps all societies in history before our own have had either slavery or something very similar to it.
Uh-huh.
And indeed, as you implied yourself, we have people who, in terms of economic status, are very close to slave. They may have notional freedom, but that freedom isn't worth very much to them. without other things to go with it.
Susan Trajari, were women slaves essentially in Roman society? I mean, I'm trying to pick a fight here with you.
And, yes, and, I can see.
I mean, my impression is that they really were second-class citizens in spite of all this about inheriting through their fathers or brothers and all of that.
I think not, except insofar as we were until very recently, and perhaps a lot of people would argue women still are. I would always put the Romans second only to the English-speaking world. I shall no doubt get into an argument with the new Prime Minister of France over this.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But it seems to me that the position of women has been more favourable for longer in the English-speaking world and in Rome than in any other society in human history that we know about. And the same with slaves. Richard picked up exactly the point I would make, that slavery was accepted as part of the human organization. The Romans said it was part of the law of all peoples.
Mm-hmm.
They said it was against nature. The Roman theorists said it was against nature.
But they practiced it nonetheless.
But of course they followed the law of all peoples, and then they had refinements on this by Roman law, which was actually more liberal than most of the law of other peoples.
Richard Talbert?
Yes, yes. And two features I think it's very important for us today to bear in mind about Roman slavery were, first, that it was not race-based. There was no question of color in all this. Romans didn't have that color sense or color prejudice. And secondly, there were, for many, by no means all, but for many Roman slaves, there was a real opportunity of gaining their freedom, their manumission, and going on to be completely free people in society. So slavery could be a transitory state in terms of generations.
Is it fair to say that when we talk about changing perspectives on Roman history, are we softening the picture by talking the way you're talking here, looking back on the Romans and essentially exonerating them of this of this practice?
I think a lot of scholars would in fact blame them even more than used to be done. But one hopes with better and more detailed grounds for blaming them.
Mm-hmm. Richard Talbert.
I think with this recent emphasis, which the Institute reflects on looking deeper at social history, we are aware more than ever of how dirty Roman society was, how high the population density was in communities, how cruel it was, how savage punishments were, how arbitrary government was, and so on and so forth. No, I think Romans aren't being exonerated at all in all these respects.
You're listening to Soundings, a weekly cultural affairs program featuring conversations and commentary from the National Humanities Center. I'm Wayne Pond. The topic this week on Soundings is changing perspectives on the early Roman Empire. My guests are Susan Trajari of Stanford University and Richard Talbert of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Is it possible to generalize here, Susan Trajari, Richard Talbert, and talk about historical analogies? How is it that you historians look back to these bygone days and number one, draw insights that on their own terms have merit amongst you historians, and at the same time make sense in terms of historical analogies that teach us the lessons of history? Susan, what about this?
Well, I think we need to be as conscious as we can of the history of our own day and of other periods as well in order to have suggestions of questions that we might ask about the ancient world. And then, of course, it's the process the other way around, which I think is what you're really getting at, about what we learn from the ancient world about today.
Uh-huh.
And in my own recent work, I found it fascinating trying to delve deeper into what they think about marriage because of the unlikeness of many of the Roman practices and customs on marriage.
Compared to us, you
compared
mean?
Compared to us, uh-huh. and what it might indeed suggest in terms of practice for nowadays. Uh-huh. The major thing is that in theory, consent is the one thing that makes a marriage for the Romans.
In other words,
the state doesn't get in on the act.
The women were not browbeaten. I mean, they did have a vote here. They could say yay or nay.
They had to. It wasn't a marriage unless the woman said yay.
Uh-huh.
And the same for the man. And there is really this is the theory. There is no third-party ratification needed, normally.
You're telling me that romantic love is a Roman practice.
No, I'm telling you consent to marry, which is rather different, I think. I myself would believe in a certain amount of romantic love in the Roman period. That's more controversial. But consent to marry and continuing consent to be married is the essence of the institution. And the result is, notice that the consent to marriage is bilateral.
I see.
The result of this is that the decision to divorce can be unilateral.
And there's the unfairness.
No, that's a good... Well, let's not be too moralizing about it. That might be a good thing.
Explain that to me.
Well, the decision to divorce could be made by either husband or wife.
Oh, I see. Not just the male prerogative.
Not just the male prerogative.
Fair enough.
And the person who decides to divorce has the courtesy to inform the partner, let's hope.
That sounds very modern.
And relations. Doesn't happen now. You'd have to go and give evidence that there should be a divorce, and you'd have to have a ratification by an outside authority. The difference with the Romans is no ratification is needed by an outside authority. So, in fact, they're at a higher degree of freedom than has ever been achieved in a Western democracy, at least, since.
Richard?
I think in more general terms, Susan has, in talking about marriage and divorce, has put her finger on something that is fascinating about the Romans, that there is much about them which seems familiar to us, but that, and that sucks us in, that gets us excited, but when we look more closely, we realize some of the differences, and that's very stimulating in itself, for anybody who has an intellectual interest in history. And it also helps us, I think, to step back and see our own society, our own world, in a new perspective.
Speaking of our own world, the 1990s, there is a great debate raging in the universities and, in fact, in the popular culture these days about what it is that we mean when we talk about our Western inheritance. We're defining ourselves, the Western canon. What difference does the kind of scholarship that you two folks are engaged in make to that debate? Are you, I take it you're not going to be monolithic defenders or attackers, but tell me about Roman history in those terms. Richard?
Well, I think, Wayne, there are two levels here, and the first one is perhaps less controversial, and it's very important from the aspect of teaching, and that is, as you know, so much in the United States comes in the basis, the planning of the United States comes from the Roman model. It was...
What would Thomas Jefferson have been without all of those...
Surely.
All those books about surely. Rome and Greece.
And I confess against myself what a culture shock it was for me coming to teach in the United States for the first time and giving an introductory Roman history course and beginning, as I always do, by talking about the Roman Constitution, the Senate, the tribunes, their veto. And the more I did this in the early weeks, the more the audience listened spellbound and sat closer and closer to the edges of their seats. And I was baffled by this because when you do it in Canada or the United Kingdom, as I have before, the audience goes to sleep or leaves, and you have a gratifying reduction in the numbers in your class. And so naively, I asked one or two in private after a class, why are you all still here? Why are you so fascinated by this? And they said, but sir, you're telling us about our own country. You're telling us about the world around us today. And Rome certainly has a very important value in that respect.
All right, now that's one aspect. You mentioned two. What else do you have in mind?
I think the other level is going back to this point, trotting out the old tag, that all history is contemporary history, that we are fascinated by economics today, by administration, by social structures, the sorts of things we've been talking about in this institute, the question of ethnic or color prejudice, for example, multiculturalism. The study of Greek and Roman antiquity has a great deal to contribute here.
Susan, let me challenge you again. I mean, does it mean on the face of it, because you are interested in women and the family, gender, issues of sexuality and gender, that you are automatically deconstructing Roman history and that you are automatically challenging the received notions that constitute what some of these major strands in our Western canon?
Well, I think social historians in general, whether it's the family or slavery or other topics that they're looking at, are always snapping up the unconsidered trifles left over by the politico-military historians or the ones who are chiefly interested in the writings of the historian as historiography. So that's why we use our net so widely to try and scoop up these little scraps of information and build them up into what we hope is a coherent picture of, of social structure.
But do they nonetheless become part of the ammunition for the destruction of the Western canon? I mean, are they necessarily an ideological kind of thing? The looking and at and doing of history in terms of gender and ethnicity, things like that.
Are you suggesting that one would write history in order to bring about a political end?
Oh, I'm suggesting that it's been suggested. Tell me about that in terms of your own scholarship.
Well, I should think that a political objective would be a byproduct of history, just as, unfortunately, the atom bomb is a byproduct of research in nuclear physics. I don't think a real historian goes into history in order to prove a political point. A real historian goes into history in order to present a thesis about the historical period he's concentrating on.
You are coming dangerously close to a word like objectivity. I thought that went up.
I am, and I've just used his when I should say his or her, of course. Many of the historians in women history in general, of course, are not men.
Richard Talbert.
On the multicultural debate, I think the one thing that the study of Roman history does underline for us over and over again was the astonishing openness of Roman society. To be sure, it was a society that had its ethnic prejudices, but for someone who was prepared to assimilate to Roman language and Roman ways, Rome offered great opportunities.
This was a world where tolerance was a sort of a wonderful concept that was taken very seriously. Have I got this right?
Well, a lot depends, of course, on how you define tolerance. If you think it's tolerant for the conquering power to say to the local, the native, come join me, learn my language, assimilate to my ways, and there are great rewards in store for you, then yes, to offer that rather than simply to mow them all down and kill them is very tolerant indeed, very generous.
I was thinking of things like polytheism, that is to say that one would tolerate a great variety of how do you put it, household gods, household beliefs. On that score, we give the Romans high marks. Do we not?
Yes, we do. Yes. Even, in fact, with their treatment of the Christians, because it's little appreciated that the whole purpose of the persecutions, as we call them, was to give these wayward Christians an opportunity to come back to the practice of the Romans, which, after all, were just the standard practices of all Western societies or in that world in that time.
Susan Trajari, Richard Talbert, what do you have to say as professional historians of Rome about our popular images of Rome? I'm thinking of Cecil B. DeMille and Dino De Laurentiis and Spartacus and
the life of Brian.
Exactly. How about this, Richard?
Yes, the popular images are fine. The only thing I want to do is add to them those elements which no movie can give you, alas. Nothing, I think, can convey the stench, the overcrowding, the competitiveness, the heat of Roman society. And many of those things which we and movie makers sweetly take for granted, I think, were not the case. Roman baths, we think, were a wonderful thing, and up to a point they were. And we envisage sparkling, chlorinated blue pools. Alas, I think most of the time the water was muddy and horribly dirty.
Oh, my goodness. Susan, are you glad that you're alive now rather than then?
Well, I think our hygiene leaves something to be desired sometimes, but on the whole, of course, we have it much better now. Mm-hmm. Life is safer. Oh. But the threat of war is not so remote as it was in the first 2 centuries A.D.
What about these popular images?
The popular images, of course, are sensational. They make good drama. They do tend to look on the more dramatic sides of life, the torture of slaves, crucifixion, terrible things happening in the quarries. I remember vivid images of that sometimes. And this highly fictitious picture of the imperial family going around poisoning each other the whole time.
I Claudius has got it wrong?
Well, Robert Graves got it wrong. I Claudius is a very faithful rendering, really, of Robert Graves. They only put in one or two extra sensational items.
But Graves himself is not a faithful rendering of Roman history.
Robert Graves did a very good job of reading the literary sources on Roman history. He renders them very accurately. but he didn't take them with enough salt.
Well, let me be specific. I can't cite chapter and verse here, but there's a new biography out of Caligula, and as I understand it, it says, yes, indeed, this was a monster. Now, how do you Roman historians figure that sort of thing out?
It's difficult to whitewash Caligula because we haven't got the sources to show that he was not a monster. Uh-huh. So, I'm going to pass this back to Richard in a second, but Richard is right. It doesn't matter if the emperor's a monster. Things can keep going for 4 years perfectly well without him taking an interest.
Richard?
And just to refine what you're saying, Wayne, actually, yes, you're talking about a biography which I believe has only just hit the bookstalls, mm-hmm. and indeed I haven't seen it. But there was another one published about a year ago, which is maybe not so sensational, still very useful, and does make the excellent point, to my mind, that most of the things which Caligula enjoyed doing were very conventional. Most Romans, if they could get a hand on a chariot, loved driving it round at high speed. And if you could drive it over the sea, as Caligula did, even better. They liked getting women. They liked going to shows. They liked to think of themselves as high and mighty, maybe even divine, as Caligula wanted to be. He was a very ordinary kind of guy. He just got enhanced opportunities to indulge his whims.
Very fond of his sisters.
Richard Talbert teaches at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, Susan Trajari at Stanford University. Richard Talbert and Susan Trajari recently took part in an institute entitled Changing Perspectives on the Early Roman Empire, under the sponsorship of the National Endowment for the Humanities. You're listening to Soundings, a weekly cultural affairs program featuring conversations and commentary from the National Humanities Center. I'm Wayne Pond. Soundings on Early Roman Culture is available on cassette. For a copy of the preceding conversation, send $5 to the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. The zip code is 27709. Please ask for program number 583. That's program number 583. The address again is the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, the zip code 27709. Send $2 for a complete listing of Soundings discussions available on cassettes. And when you write, please mention the call letters of this radio station. The National Humanities Center is eager to hear your comments about Soundings.
You've been listening to Soundings, a weekly cultural affairs program featuring conversations and commentary from the National Humanities Center. Next week, a conversation about a new anthology. The topic will be the Norton Book of Friendship, which was published last month. Wayne Pond will talk with Ronald Sharp of Kenyon College. With Eudora Welty, Ronald Sharp is co-editor of the Norton Book of Friendship. Thanks for listening to Soundings. Please join us again next week at this time on this radio station. Partial support for this program comes from the A.J. Fletcher Foundation and from Carolina Power and Light, where listening generates powerful ideas. Major funding for Soundings comes from the National Endowment for the Humanities.
Rethinking Roman History, this week on Soundings. I'm Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Listen for historians Susan Trajari of Stanford University and Richard Talbert of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Susan Trajari and Richard Talbert discuss changing historical perspectives on Roman politics, domestic life, and social structures. Rethinking Roman History, some answers and insights from the National Humanities Center, this week on Soundings.